ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
When energy costs jump, everyone feels it. At the Bowser, on the power bill, and across the economy.
I'm Alan Kohler.
And I'm Carrington Clark. On ABC Business Daily's Fuelcast, we break down the latest in fuel, energy, and the forces driving prices.
It's a quick, clear update on what's moving, why it matters, and what it can mean for your wallet and the wider economy.
Find Fuelcast in the ABC Business Daily feed on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Donald Trump has ordered a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz after peace talks with Iran failed over the weekend. Our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, has reiterated that Australia hasn't been asked to assist and called for the resumption of peace talks and an end to the conflict. It comes as the Prime Minister gets set to jet off to Malaysia and Brunei for another round of petro-diplomacy. He's trying to shore up our fuel supplies. And as the instability continues, there's been a defence shake-up at home, with a new Chief of the Defence Force taking the reins and Australia's first ever female Chief of Army announced. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Jacob Greber.
And Jacob, thank you for doing such an excellent job telling the nation and the world about Australian politics. You did an excellent job. Did you miss me a little bit?
We definitely missed you, PK, but it was fun. It was fun. Thank you for giving me the keys to the,
mate, the keys HMAS are always yours.
Politics Now and letting me kind of chuck a few laps in the car park with it. It was good fun.
Chuck a couple of Yuis, which you did, I saw. Look, let's talk about some Yuis of our own. We're going to get to the new Chief of the Defence Force and the PM's impending trip to Malaysia and Brunei. But first, Donald Trump has ordered the US Navy to blockade the Strait of Hormuz. Comes after the talks around a lasting peace deal. Remember, we're in a two-week ceasefire period, but they failed over the weekend. JD Vance announcing that they'd fallen over. Since then, the president has spoken and, you know, his tone is confusing to me. I mean, he clearly wanted an off-ramp, didn't get a deal. Jacob, we had this fragile ceasefire. Feels like it may be ratcheting up again.
I think the problem has always been that Iran has for now got a bit of a whip hand on all of this. And it's got it because it's been able to shut down such a vital trade route to the world. They've put their foot on the neck of the global economy, and they've been able to extract a cost or impose a cost on everybody, which is rising energy prices. And it's interesting, the United States has more capacity than most to withstand that and, if you like, ignore that pressure because America generates and produces so much energy, whereas others, like little old Australia, we have to import a lot of liquid fuels, and so we're going to feel the pain more quickly. But there are others who are feeling it far worse than us. Sri Lanka, Thailand, Vietnam are some of the countries I'm hearing where things are getting really difficult. I have no idea, and that's probably shameful, but I would hate to know what's going on in parts of Africa. South America. So the costs are much higher there. On America, they can withstand it, but clearly not forever. And so Donald Trump has sought to create a two-week window. The point being from the Iranian position, if they open the straits, America starts bombing again. That's their calculation. The bombing stopped because they were squeezing the global economy. That's their leverage. That's the lever they pull. And so Donald Trump is now threatening a blockade of his own.
Yeah.
Feels a bit counterintuitive, but it's really about shutting down any of those ships that are coming out of the Gulf with Iran's imprimatur. And these are ships that are probably heading to places like China. Mm. And so Trump now wants to use military equipment, American lives, to create a blockade that then hurts China, presumably to ratchet pressure up back on Iran. That's my simplistic sort of view of what's going on.
I think that's a good view. The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was really quick to reiterate Australia hadn't been asked to assist the US. He pointed out Australia had already extended the time its wedge tail will assist in the Middle East, part of the so-called defensive, not offensive, as we've all heard, role Australia plays to assist the UAE, but also other Gulf states in kind of the consequences that they're facing as a result of this. But I just want to say, Jacob, we've heard this before from the Prime Minister, this we've not been asked to assist. And yet I think it's at least twice that I remember, I might have another time, may have been missed in my memory, but where the US president has actively used the word Australia in his, you know, listing of countries that have not come to the party. So there is a sort of inconsistency that I've always found a little puzzling between the Prime Minister's form of language and then the way the US president views it. Now, I'm sure there is, you know, there's always a reason for that in terms of when is a request, you know, like how does that look? But I thought that was interesting, again, that the Prime Minister wanted to draw that point. And also, very important to mention, that we've heard a sort of increasing line from the government, which is really negative towards the US, it's fair to say, or Donald Trump and the way he has framed the sort of threats he's made against Iran, its civilization over the last week, which you've been talking about. Like all of that has been a shift from our government. And then at the same time, we've got the Prime Minister going out of his way to look very busy that he's securing our fuel supplies, because he knows, in terms of our Australian audience, Australian voters, his most important task is to look very busy when it comes to that, right?
It's the only thing I think that he's focused on, quite frankly.
It's the only thing he has control over.
Some of his people will dispute that, and they'll say that the government's still working on a whole lot of stuff, and indeed they've announced a new chief of defence today, but his real focus is every day on this question of securing supply of fuel from our Asian trading partners. As you say, he's off again, Malaysia and Brunei this week. Those are vital conversations. I think how it's evolved a little bit is, you know, I don't know he's going in there saying, you know, if you don't give us fuel, we won't export gas. Because we're not... That's a threat that we wouldn't seriously carry out, I don't think, as a country. So
is it an implied...
Well, I'm not even sure about that. I think it's just an attempt to stop this becoming a very antagonistic dog-eat-dog scenario. That's really what the government's hoping it can pull off with this diplomacy, petro-diplomacy that it's doing around the region. The relationship with the United States seems to be deteriorating. He's not, as far as we know, had a conversation with the president in the last few weeks as this has deteriorated. But I tell you who he has had a conversation with, the premier of China, counterparts in Asia, and no doubt Europe. I think that is quite striking. America is in a war and we're not in there with him directly. That's a big change on history, and certainly history in my lifetime.
Yeah, it's a huge change. And the government would say, no, the US is still our first ally if pressed. That is, that's where our alliance is. But at the same time, you're seeing a lot of contingency planning. And this is around, again, our supply lines and what matters most, which is getting supplies into the country, fuel, fertilizer, making sure that Australians in a few months don't become more and more vulnerable. Now, tell you why it matters, because as we are recording, Iran basically has warned that a US blockade of the Strait of Hormuz would violate the ceasefire. So we're in the middle of the ceasefire period, Jacob, but, you know, this ceasefire could be over, like by the time you even listen, or not. I don't know. That's a very unpredictable situation. But I think even in saying they want to do that, I think it leads to some pretty significant ramifications. And the biggest one for us, as we've said many times on this podcast, is, of course, economically. Now, the Prime Minister is warning the longer it goes, the bigger impact it will have. Keeps talking again in his press conference today, announcing a few other things which we'll get to. He again says the budget won't be prepared till very late in the piece. So a lot of ideas swirling, a lot of things being, you know, bounced around in the media to get the public ready for some big changes like cuts to the NDIS and other big significant shifts. But him consistently telling us nothing will be landed is because, you know, there's a month to the budget. He's right, actually. A lot could change. Like, you know, we are, if the ceasefire fails and we're back in a kind of a protracted war situation, that is pretty significant a shift. Which takes me to a 9 papers report. It's modelling just the consequences on the economy if we see a continuation of what is an oil crisis and a potential deep recession. This is getting very serious and very real, isn't it, Jacob? And when you look at news like this war might flare up again, it just shows that the economic ramifications are going to start being baked in, aren't they? Mm.
And I wrote about that on Saturday morning, if you have a look on the ABC website. And I started that piece really at the beginning of the week looking for positive signs, looking for good news, looking for reasons why we'd be resilient as a country. And they exist. We do export energy. We do generate income out of this conflict in a kind of perverse sort of way. Another one of those budget fanatics, Chris Richardson, he predicts that it's something like $32 billion in additional revenue for the government since MIEFA as a result of rising commodity prices around the world. So it's not all bad. But when you get into the detail, when you start asking yourself questions about how this plays out, It isn't great. It really isn't great. There's a lot of predictions that inflation's going to have a 6 in front of it in the current quarter that we're in, annual inflation of 6%. That puts us back to where we were in 2022. That is a tax on everybody, but particularly poor people and middle-income people. Real, really, really challenging stuff for them. And then look at what people are spending money on, some of the interesting breakdowns that the banks can give you, because they can see in almost real time what people are spending money on, every dollar. Big spike in energy spending, you would expect that. Prices have gone up. But how are they making that work? Well, they're cutting spending dramatically on travel, on hotels, on anything discretionary. People are pulling back on it. And then you look at the consumer confidence figures. So what I'm saying is all of that, if this continues, if there isn't a circuit breaker, all of that points to a consumer strike or contraction. And then that's when you start getting into these recessionary type effects. Job market might start to wobble if it continues. You kind of see the flow on. I don't know that recession is where we're headed, but a lot of people speculating that that's what's on the cards if this doesn't recover. And so, yeah, we you and I can only guess at what the next move is in the Gulf. It's so hard to know how this plays out. You can kind of go through the logical steps of how Iran might behave, how the White House might behave. But if you're putting a budget together in 4 weeks, it's no wonder the Prime Minister's telling everybody they'll be finalising this at the last minute.
Yeah, and that's all, again, about preparing us, getting people used to a new normal of complete instability around all of this. So that's all pretty, you know, key.
You taking your roof racks off your car?
Well, look, don't even start with my car. Pause on that. Because,
have you pumped up the tyres? Are you pumping up your tyres?
Let's go to the advertising campaign telling us what to do with our cars to preserve fuel. That's been sort of criticised a bit.
So I don't know about you, Pico. I don't have a problem with this ad campaign. I guess journos jump up and down all the time when we see ad campaigns. You know, they're spending quote-unquote people's money to tell us something we already know. But I mean, this is one of those things just to remind people that there are ways to reduce how much fuel you use, and they're actually surprisingly simple. A lot of people will find that patronizing, and of course I know how to do this. I don't need the government to tell me. And I tell you why I don't think this is a sinister plot to make in the government's favor. I don't think these ads help the government in any way. They just remind people that this is a very unpleasant situation.
I think they do remind people it's unpleasant. Do they help the government? I don't know. Some of the tips are actually useful. I didn't know some of those things. Maybe you do because you're a petrol head or not a petrol head.
I'm actually not a petrol head.
Yeah, I know. You're so not a petrol head. Okay, I didn't know some of these things. Like some people are into cars and they know these things. I didn't know these things, okay? So I didn't know.
So it's actually a useful campaign then, isn't it? It's sure. a useful campaign.
I mean,
campaign.
It is for me. I could have also Google searched it, but I didn't. So maybe it's useful. I don't know. Park whether it's useful or not. I'm sure it's useful for some people. They have to do everything they can, I suppose, if we're trying to make sure all the petrol that we use is used in the most efficient way possible when there's a shortage. So let's give them some.
But the opposition's got, you know, the opposition's going at them for this. They're calling it a waste. They're saying that this is not appropriate. And I, frankly, I don't understand really the point. I think the opposition is on stronger ground when it complains that the government, you know, we can go through the details of this, but they're on stronger ground when they're complaining about the government hasn't done enough or is not doing enough to get diesel to the right places, or how do we know what they're doing because the data is a little murky. Everyone has to go and sort of Google weird maps looking at ships traveling through the Gulf and traveling around the world. And I think that's where the government gets hit a little more.
Yeah, and I understand the criticism that sometimes these campaigns look a little bit, you know, historically speaking as well, like a bit of government propaganda, right? And that's where money being used for busy work so the government looks relevant. Maybe there is some case to make that, but I do think, you know, whatever, like there are some useful tips in it that are probably going to lead to some fuel efficiency, like me and the tyres and the roof racks. Like now I know that, and I do have a petrol car. So there you go. I know some stuff I didn't know.
You know, if you drive, someone had this number the other day. If the whole country drove 80 kilometres an hour instead of 100 kilometres an hour, the nation's fuel reserves would go up by 10 days or some extraordinary amount like that.
Well, can we collectively agree to do that, though?
Good luck.
Rather than the hoonheads who overtake me and beat me and tailgate me and make me feel really bad when I'm going to. I mean, we famously once, me and my partner, and if she listens to this, she'll be like, we got fined for going too slow on the highway, which shocked us immensely, can I say, because we're in the left lane, like we're doing the right thing where you can overtake.
Well, now you could defend it as,
that's what
you
I'm
know,
saying.
Extending Australia's fuel reserves.
Yeah, not back then. I can tell you that we did not have a fuel problem at the time. Okay, so, all right, there's the criticism of the campaign. We've got the Prime Minister with this, you know, this cautious going out of our way to try and secure supplies. He's been to Singapore. He's going to a couple of other countries, building relationships. I think there is lots to say that's positive about this. Politically, Jacob, very smart for the Prime Minister to look so active, so hands on all the levers of doing everything he can. Now, one of the questions at the press conference that I thought was interesting was, you know, essentially, I don't remember the exact words of the question, but it was, you know, is it fair for us to try and get to the front of the queue like this with the fuel? And I thought it was it's a great question. People should ask whatever they like, but it's interesting because do you remember?
Actually, it was me. I asked that question, PK.
Was that you?
I've just remembered.
Well, that is so funny that I've just come back from holidays, clearly not sharp enough that I didn't remember it was you. Jacob, I feel embarrassed, but I'm going to say the point, which is we were in a race to get vaccines, or Australians at least thought we should be in a race to get them ahead of everyone else so we can get on with things. Now, Scott Morrison was in trouble for not racing. Now, this guy, having watched that and realising he was seen as too slow at the start of the fuel crisis, he's got his foot on the accelerator, boom, boom, hopefully not too hard because of the petrol cost, but he's got his foot on the accelerator getting to the front of the queue. That's what he's doing here. And his calculation is, do Australians think, oh, let's be fair and share the fuel with the world? No, they don't. Do you think they do? No.
And put yourself in the position of some of these countries. They are going to be getting very, very desperate. You know, those countries have very large rural economies where people are trying to feed the population. It gets desperate very quickly when you don't have diesel. They don't have the same financial capacity that Australia does. That sounds a little tone deaf around parts of the regions when we say we've secured our spot at the top of the queue. If this gets willing, let's see how that goes. And the Prime Minister, I think he's very, very determined to make sure that doesn't happen. Like, let's be fair to what he's doing here. He's trying to make sure that the system as it currently operates will continue to operate. And he's also, I think the other interesting thing about the press conference we've just seen from the Prime Minister, he was asked by another one of our colleagues whether he supported this growing momentum in parts of the community, definitely in the parts of the political class, for a tax on gas, a 25% tax on gas. Did he recognise that there was this momentum. And there are plenty of counter arguments against it. And we've actually heard one of them from the resources minister this morning when she pointed out that actually it was a lot of foreign companies that built this industry. It was their capital that created the capacity that Australians now use. Prime Minister didn't want to go there at all. He just said, well, I'm off. Words to the effect of next question. And what he's concerned there is he doesn't want to be in this debate a day or so before he sits in a room with, for instance, the Prime Minister of Malaysia, a country that has a company called Petronas that has invested a lot of money in the Gladstone LNG projects. Same story with Brunei, I suspect. So very real sensitivity there. He's trying to dance that line.
He is dancing. Now, the Prime Minister stood up today with Richard Marles who is the Defence Minister and the Deputy Prime Minister, to make a pretty important announcement. There is a new head of the Australian Defence Force. It's a significant reshuffle of our Defence Force. The former Navy Chief, Mark Hammond, will become the new head of the Australian Defence Force. And at the same time, we've got the nation's first female Army Chief, which is again quite significant, Susan Coyle. We've been waiting for this, Jacob. You were there for the announcement. Is it a big deal and what does it signal?
The main point about this announcement, I think, is that they've picked a Navy officer, very, very senior, very, very experienced Navy officer. He's also a submariner. He's commanded the Collins-class submarines. What does that tell you, PK, about the number one priority? Well, it's the big, big thing that we are buying off the Americans and the Brits, the $350 billion AUKUS submarine program. And Vice Admiral, soon to be Admiral Mark Hammond, is the person in charge of that project at the moment. So I think that sends a very, very strong signal about the priority, the ongoing priority. As much as that will upset quite a few people who think we shouldn't be doing this, such as Malcolm Turnbull and Paul Keating. So the government really ploughing ahead with that strategy. Do you think, did they have any other choice? I don't know.
Well, they've locked into this strategy. And once you lock in, you have to execute that lock in, right? So it's obvious
all or nothing,
choice because
it?
Of that. That's right. The first ever female chief of army, Susan Coyle, is also a significant announcement. I think historically significant, but also she has nearly 40 years of experience in the ADF. So we are talking about a pretty well-credentialed person. All of these changes, can I say, have been long anticipated. I mean, we've been waiting and waiting for the replacement. I think the government's been working on this for a while and been ready to announce. I think last week's revelation, that the police had charged Ben Robert Smith. Probably they needed a little distance from that particular event because that is very significant. And, you know, obviously they don't want these two things to be people to be asked questions anywhere near the same days. So I think now you're seeing an announcement that's been sort of long in the planning from this government. And I think it'll be interesting to see the way now with these appointments, some of the shifts that we've already had earmarked, but for the emphasis of the Defence Force and the emphasis of the kind of work they do, because there has been long planned changes to what we want to put priority into. I want to return, though, if I can, sort of thematically, to the big conundrum, which is AUKUS and the US relationship. Yes, Albanese met with Trump and, you know, they sort of reset their relationship or created a relationship of sorts. But I do think now with this ongoing crisis at the Strait of Hormuz, the pressure that may be on Australia, even if the PM says he hasn't been asked about how we operate around that, I mean, it just shows how much the ADF is at play at the moment.
Yeah, and the incoming head of defence, Mark Hammond, was actually asked that question about whether Australia would or should contribute to a blockade. And again, he made that clear statement that Australia has not received such a request. And I think that's quite important because a lot of this stuff, as you sort of hinted earlier in our pod today, a lot of this stuff happens in a sort of subtle way. Australia sounded out back door, would you be able to provide? And then you get the formal request later. It doesn't happen immediately that the request lobs in the email inbox and the Prime Minister's sort of spots it for the first time. That stuff's all very managed. And the Vice Admiral was making the point that actually Australia does have, I think he said, 10 vessels currently at sea, or maybe there's 10 operational serious ships, and 8 of them are at sea. So he's essentially saying, look, we do have capacity.
He is saying that. Yeah, that was an interesting answer. Can I just say before we leave, we have a little bit of an announcement to make.
Oh, exciting.
Yeah, it is. Very exciting, actually. Fran Kelly and I, get this, we've been making the Party Room political podcast now, before we started going daily with politics now as well, but the Party Room for 10 years.
Did the internet even exist 10 years ago? 10 years is like a century in podcast history.
I love it
history,
when you accidentally sound like a boomer and you're not even one. Yes, it did, my friend. Look, no, but we were early adopters once a week, and many of you who are listening to politics now and now listen, of course, every day, are from that era, still with us, and now listen every day as well. But we're going to do a live show to celebrate the fact that
And so you should.
Yeah, like, because it is significant. And, you know, podcasts, there's a lot of new ones being made, and including this daily one, like me and you, Jacob. But this has been going on for a while, and it's really become very, I think, important in people's kind of ecosystem of media. So we will be celebrating it at the ABC's Ultimo building in Sydney. Completely free, but you need to book a ticket, and the link to book that ticket has just gone live. So check out the show notes for today's episode and please come along. We'd love you to be there. I know, by the way, as a Melburnian, because I have to travel to the show, that if you are in Melbourne or if you're in the NT, you're like, Sydney again. It is going to be in Sydney. We have the right place to do it there. We have to choose a location. Do not be offended if you're national and you're not there. If you happen to be in Sydney or an interstater, please come along.
And they're great fun. Like, I took part in the one last year in Canberra, and I was amazed that people would come out on a Tuesday night, but they did. The theatre was full. It was good energy. And I got to say, you, the number of people who come up to me and mention the podcast, maybe that's a Canberra crowd. Maybe Canberra loves the podcast, but I think you would sort of compete there and say that happens elsewhere in the country as well.
It happens to me across the country, I've got to say, yeah.
There is definitely a real audience there. They participate, and it's great fun to be able to do it.
Yeah, so come along. In the show notes tomorrow, Tom Crowley and I will be talking about the latest political developments. Who knows what will transpire overnight? Hopefully good stuff, not bad stuff, but if it's bad stuff, we'll still talk about it. Send any questions to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. Jacob, thank you for doing a legendary effort of hosting the show, and today, of course, being my regular co-host. Have a good day.
Love doing it. Take care.